Thank you everyone for joining us at this morning's webinar, where we're going to be reflecting on yesterday's budget announcements. It's nice just looking down the participant list. It's nice to see so many familiar clients, contacts, and friends of the firm. It sort of reminds me that it's sort of sobering thought, really. It's over 18 months since Rishi Sunak's first budget. And then one of our last acts was to, I think it was Friday the 13th, March 2020. One of our last acts was to have a budget seminar actually in our offices, at which point, you know, the word furlough had us all scrambling through our dictionaries, quite frankly. Anyway, this is the new sort of brave virtual world. I'm pleased to say that this morning we've assembled a panel of some of our senior leaders who are going to be giving us their expertise on those announcements from yesterday that are particularly pertinent to their areas of practice. You know, there wasn't a huge amount from a tax perspective, and to a certain extent I expect our panelists might, you know, comment on one or two things that weren't announced or that perhaps were glaring omissions by the Chancellor. In terms of running order, we're going to start with a sort of big picture lot from our managing partner Marvin Rust, and then we're going to turn to some real estate matters. Obviously business rates has been a big issue as the high street emerges from the pandemic. Claire is going to talk us through some interesting corporation tax changes. I have Paul Baldwin with me, at the head of our restructuring tax team, who's managed to pull out a couple of things that are going to be particularly pertinent to the distressed environment as businesses, you know, may start to struggle. And we also have Louise with us, who's going to be looking at some of the employment tax announcements. So actually I should just also just mention that we do have a question and answer facility. We have about an hour this morning, so you can submit any questions as we go along, and to the extent that we have some time left towards the end, we'll be picking up on some of those questions and trying to answer them as best as we can in real time. Anyway, without further ado, I'm going to hand the floor over to our managing partner, Marvin Rust, who's going to, as I say, give us his overall reaction on yesterday's announcements. And I would say, Marvin, what caught your eye? What's the Chancellor missed out on? And should our clients be happy?
Three questions. It was a curious budget, I suppose. Curious in that it lacked the usual amount of tax technical changes. Curious in that he announced things that were then deferred to take effect, good and bad. And curious because it didn't really, to me, set out a clear long-term agenda for business. So initially, my reaction to the third question, Jonathan, is I don't think our clients will be particularly thrilled with what he set out. And the reason for that really is fundamentally economics, I think. So in the short term, UK GDP is growing very rapidly. It's obviously bouncing back from poor numbers last year and the year before. Well, the year before, I suppose, but poor numbers. Last year was obviously better in fiscal year terms. And forecasting for 2022, a 6% GDP rise, fantastic. This is like China, growth territory. But of course, it reflects effectively the poor performance coming out of COVID. What I thought was more interesting, though, was his forecast for years 24, 25 and 26, which show GDP growth below our long-term trend of 2%. So effectively, critically, you could say that his policy announcements yesterday are telling us that in 3 years' time, as we head towards an election, which I find, again, curious as to why he would set out policy in this way, we will have some long-term growth of around 1.3, 1.6, 1.7%, according to the OBR, based on what he set out. Inflation, obviously, big news right now. CPI, DOPR thinks will peak around 4%. I think it's actually slightly above 4%, but 4% is the average rate for 2022, before dropping back to what OBR regard as, I think, the target rate of what the Chancellor is targeting. And lo and behold, in the years 25 and 26, they expect CPI rate to be exactly 2.0 and 2.0, which is, of course, where the government is supposedly aiming for. Curious. Remarkable that their forecasting is so good that 4 or 5 years out, it comes at precisely the right number. I think there's an interesting piece around employment. In terms of productivity and growing the UK economy, we can only do it two ways, really. One is the existing workforce have to become more productive. And there were some announcements, obviously, which we're going to talk about shortly, that underpin some of those things, through investment in CapEx and R&D spend and reshaping the UK economy to focus on certain sectors. But fundamentally, in order to expand the UK economy, we need more people working. Long-term unemployment rate is forecast to fall slightly to 1.5 million. Today, it's about 1.7 million. So really not much change there. So we're not really saying that we're getting huge numbers of unemployed people working that were not productive going forward. And he is forecasting that the employment labour market will rise from some 32.6 million people today to around 33.4 million. So plus 800,000 people over the 5 year period. Now, is that enough to make up for effectively the loss in terms of immigration and people who were working over the past 18 months to 2 years? That's a big question mark to my mind, and I suspect that we will see a change in immigration strategy as the labour market tightens, which I'm sure it will over the coming 12 months or so. We're not going to save any more, apparently, so consumer saving is going to be flat now compared to 5 years out, so it's not like we're earning more money and saving it. And the outlook for individuals is pretty modest, to be honest, about 1% real rise in household incomes each year for 5 years. Over 5 years, that's 5%, so it's not immaterial, but it's not that significant. Government spend is increasing at a faster rate than household spend, which again tells you something about the shape of yesterday's announcement, with significant spending increases across all departments of 3%, I think, on average over the 5 year forecast period. Now, the Chancellor did reveal that he does understand something about tax. He clearly understands what those of us who are of a certain vintage will remember as tower structures. He made the comment that those who are listening to it live, that people driving cars had saved £1,900 since the fuel tax increase has not been implemented for a period of 10 years. So that's a 10-year tower of counting how much we're all better off. Now, does anybody feel £1,900 better off driving their car? I don't think so. But clearly, he does understand some principles of taxation coming up with that tower structure principle. Overall, as I said, it was a curious mix. If he believes in, he made the intellectual argument, we should be able to fly within the UK more cheaply. So why did he not implement that immediately? Why defer that to 2023? Doesn't make a lot of sense to me, having made the argument. He also made the intellectual argument, which we'll come back to in terms of change, about R&D allowances being spent outside of the UK. Now, if he believes that is the case, and he believes that's a anti-avoidance loophole he wants to correct, why wait until 2023? Again, odd. So some good things and bad things in the sense of government strategy. But the piece that was missing, I think, from our client's perspective, Jonathan, to go to your question, was there's no long-term business plan here. There's lots of extensions of previously announced things, so that, you know, business rate relief is now going to be extended in retail and hospitality, subject to certain limits. The annual investment allowance is going to live on for another year. But why not make these things more structural, more permanent? Because that would actually then give, I think, our clients the right framework and investment environment in order to invest in the UK. And there was no announcement, which we thought there might be, around whether he was going to do something around the change in corporate tax rate, which we're expecting in 2023, given it now looks more likely than not that the US won't be increasing its tax rate. And therefore, why are we increasing our tax rate? Is it to raise revenue or some other reason? He makes a big song about the fact that it still remains the lowest rate in the G7. I think he's obviously counting federal and state tax in making that that pronouncement. And there were some good things around, I think, the bank tax levy coming down. That makes sense. You know, it's a critical part of our economy to ensure that London remains competitive, and reducing that to 3%, that makes sense to me. So those are my impressions, Jonathan. Not sure I've answered all of your questions, but hopefully some of them at least.
No, that all made sense to me, Marvin. Thanks. I tend to agree with you. It's difficult to see that there was anything that would give, particularly foreign direct investment a huge amount of confidence that that the UK is a location that they want to be coming to, vis-a-vis some of our competitors for that direct investment. So yeah, I think I agree with all of that. Anyway, one of the things that we were all looking forward to see what the landing point was going to be on was around business rates. Obviously, the high street was struggling to a certain extent even before the pandemic, and obviously as we've lived through sort of 18 months of various lockdowns, the environment's got even tougher. We were expecting some announcements yesterday. Also, on the back of the Grenfell disaster, the whole issue of paved cladding was something that really sort of strikes a chord with the public. So, Kirsten, if I could turn it over to you. So, Kirsten Muller is our head of real estate tax, for those of you who've not met him. Kirsten, there were some announcements in those areas yesterday. Could you sort of talk us through what caught your eye?
Yeah, no, thanks, Jonathan. And yeah, certainly could say that there were a number of announcements yesterday that impact the real estate industry. The two you've mentioned, and which I'll go through in a bit more detail in a second. There were some other announcements as well. You could also say that that sort of area of real estate was probably one where a lot of recycling happened. So a lot of measures that were previously announced were rehashed, including those from some years ago, and of course others were pre-announced, so they were well trailed ahead of the budget. Probably the four areas that I think are quite important for the sector is around the kind of levelling up business rates, as you've mentioned, REIT reform, which again was trailed, and then of course the sort of broad investment into housing and who's going to pay for that. I mean, if I sort of just take them in turn, I mean, in terms of levelling up in total, if you tot up all the measures, it's about 130 billion that's going to be spent on various infrastructure investments, so rail, city regions, walking and cycling, something really close to my heart, electric charging. And of course, all of those do impact, in particular, commercial property, but also residential property. And if you just think about to achieve real transformation on those points, you do need private sector involvement. So I think that is going to be the opportunity for the property sector. I guess the question to my mind right now is how you de-risk some of those longer term, more liquid investments for what are the UK's biggest investors into real estate and infrastructure, which are typically pension funds, insurance companies, where you've got that kind of dichotomy of less liquid investments and investors that may need to cash in those investments. Obviously, there was some announcement around making it possible for those funds to invest more into liquid investments going forward. Obviously, business rates, took sort of centre stage, and there's been quite a bit of discussion. I'd probably say the big disappointment, which I guess we also knew before, was that the much needed reform of business rates was again deferred. Something was released yesterday, which we're still going over in terms of the government's response to what they consider. Business rates is one of those kind of thorny areas where, frankly, even last year, raised 25 billion, that's actually down from about 32 billion the year before. It isn't actually far short of corporation tax in terms of what it raises. The system obviously is in need of reform. It just doesn't work anymore in the 21st century. And the measures announced yesterday from the 50% relief for retail, hospitality and leisure, to green investments that get a 12-month holiday on business rates, cancellation of next year's increase in business rates. I think all of those are symptomatic of a system that doesn't really work anymore the way the economy works right now. So I think all of these undoubtedly welcome. I know later we'll probably be talking a bit about other changes, but for hospitality and leisure, I think that 50% relief is undoubtedly needed, given that the VAT on hospitality and leisure will go up again from 12.5% to 20% later this year. So clearly, you sort of give one hand and take with the other. One of the other areas where business rates is going to be changed is around free evaluations. I mean, that was proposed some time ago. It's undoubtedly welcome to make the system a bit more responsive to what's happening in the real world. So overall, bit of a mix there from a business rate perspective. One of the other points, and we commented on this ahead of the budget, was around REITs. So REITs are going to be made easier as of April next year. There's been some consultation on that, and that is really linked with the asset holding company regime that is going to be introduced in the UK. Now, what's really interesting there is that the Treasury really seems to understand that actually making the UK a more attractive place for funds to be based will bring revenue to the UK, not just tax revenue, but just generally revenue in business. And of course, that does have an impact on how much tax is being collected in the country. I'm actually really interested to see how the proposed simplification of the VAT treatment of fund management fees is going to work, because that's certainly an area that does require some changes. And probably the last sort of big area is around housing. Now, overall, the numbers again are quite big, 24 billion through a number of different measures to be invested in housing, and that's generally a positive thing, and I think will be an opportunity for investors and developers. But of course, a number of those things were actually announced before the pandemic, and some of them dating back to 2016. I think the only real new thing was around the just under 2 billion fund for developing housing in brownfield sites. And that's undoubtedly, again, welcome, as is the proposed digitization of the planning system, which will hopefully unlock some of the developments that are sort of in the pipeline. Jonathan, you already mentioned building safety funds to obviously remove, replace, remedy the unsafe cladding on the housing, particularly with flats around the country. Obviously, that is going to be partly paid for by the residential property development tax that was announced back in February, March time this year. So we've certainly seen the draft legislation for that, and it's quite far reaching. And to be honest, the rate at 4% is probably at the upper end of what we expected, although the 25 million threshold is probably also higher than what we expected. So, certainly looking at the shares of the house builders yesterday, there didn't seem to be much of an impact. So I think it wasn't unexpected, and it's certainly something that's needs to happen, that kind of needs to be removed and replaced. I mean, a couple of other sort of measures along the side of kind of simplifications is around capital gains tax on residential property, which had to be notified and paid within 30 days previously. It's now 60 days. I think there's just been some practical issues around that, where HMRC found it difficult to actually issue people with taxpayer reference numbers. So they've extended that. So that's generally good news. And annual investment amounts have already been mentioned. And I'm sure it's going to be part of a wider discussion, but of course, Freeport is the other one. Three of them have been announced yesterday in terms of tax advantages, ranging from 100% allowances, capital allowances on capital expenditure, certain capital expenditure, SDLT relief. So quite a package of measures that will really encourage investment in those areas. And I think they will have a knock-on impact on certainly on the commercial property sector as well. Over to you.
Brilliant. Thanks, Kirsten. One of the things, of course, the other side of the coin whenever we talk about business rent reform is how we sort of tax the online businesses. And it was telling, there was some kind of oblique reference buried in the red book to perhaps revisiting that, but we're definitely in a holding pattern currently, as regards certainly digital sales tax. But I certainly think, in future budgets, that's a nettle still to be grasped, and is very much to my mind the other side of that sort of business rates debate. Okay, great. So we're going to move on to some of the corporation tax changes. Obviously, the kind of big sort of bad news game in the spring budget, which Claire Lambert, who's one of my partners in the corporate and international team here, will remind us of. But there was one or two, other measures. I guess the most sort of significant one for a lot of our clients would be the reform of the R&D tax credit system. So we've had consultation running for some for most of the year, in fact. So Claire's going to bring us up to speed on that. But there's one or two other things, maybe more for your sort of tax intellectual things like re-domiciling companies back to the UK. We get asked about that by our overseas affiliate firms all of the time. So there's one or two things of interest there. So Claire, over to you, if you could just do us a précis.
Yes, thanks, Jonathan. So I'm going to cover the sort of main corporate tax changes. So Jonathan just said there was a sort of slight eclectic mix in there, but nothing earth shattering, particularly seen as we'd obviously had the previous announcements at the last budget that the corporation tax rate was going up to 25% in 2023. And obviously that hasn't changed, though it doesn't seem to be any move to change that proposal. And as a result of that, what they've now announced is that the bank surcharge levy will be coming down, because obviously when the mainstream corporate rate goes up to 25%, banks are paying 8% surcharge on top of that for the bank levy. That's clearly a very significant cost to our financial sort of institutions, and the government are very keen to make sure we're still sort of front and centre for business in the UK. So the proposal is to reduce that surcharge down to 3%. Again, from the same date that the corporation tax rate increases, so banks will effectively have a 28% effective rate being the corporate tax rate plus the surcharge. So they're taxed slightly more highly than the rest of our businesses, but the idea is to try and still make them competitive with institutions in other countries. There's also a proposal to change the surcharge allowance from 25 million up to 100 million. The idea around that is to encourage challenger banks to try and give more competition in the market. So the increase of the allowance up to 100 million from 25 should hopefully bring in some new competitors into the, or help the sort of smaller challenger banks from a tax perspective to try and produce increased competition between the various institutions. So that's the main changes for the banks, which I'm sure they'll welcome given the increase in the CT rate. As Jonathan mentioned, R&D was probably one of the main announcements. There were a lot of pieces the Chancellor discussed about investing in business, investing in very specific regimes and sort of institutions in the UK to try and encourage spending on R&D. Focus was very much on trying to make sure that spend was taking place in the UK domestically. So they are proposing two changes. One is to make sure the R&D regime is focused on domestic innovation from April 2023. And this is probably a narrowing of the scope of the current rules. whereby it looks like they're proposing to prevent you from including R&D spend that's taken place outside the UK in your R&D claims. So costs of R&D that have been funded or led from the UK, but where the activity's actually been taking place overseas, may no longer qualify. So we haven't seen the detail of the proposals. Again, this is one of those items that I think they will consult further on. But the focus seems very much to be to eliminate the ability to claim R&D relief on R&D that has effectively taken place outside the UK, even though it may have been paid for in the UK. So that will impact large groups who have a centralised R&D function outside the UK. And it will also impact smaller groups who perhaps use lower cost resource outside the UK to provide their R&D. So that could be quite a significant cost to business who, you know, for anyone who is using a more international model for their R&D activity. On the flip side, the Chancellor also announced a broadening of the scope of the R&D rules. So this is looking at what actual spend qualifies, and this is to recognise that, you know, the way people do business has changed significantly since the R&D regime was introduced. So the intention is to now include costs relating to data and cloud as qualifying expenditure to try and reflect the nature, as I said, of how people and businesses are operating. What we haven't seen is any costings for these proposals. So most of these announcements normally come with costings in the budget report, but the R&D piece wasn't included to show what the net effect of that is. But we suspect the net effect is a benefit to the Treasury, given the reduction in the ability to claim for the offshore R&D, but we haven't actually seen any costings yet, so we don't know what the net effect of those two are. And it's interesting that the Chancellor is clearly trying to model our regime in the UK on other regimes that are perhaps less favourable in the global economy, because previously ours has been a very favourable regime compared to a number of other countries. But as part of obviously revenue raising, I think he's pulling back from that, going to expand the scope, but in terms of the type of costs that qualify, but very much trying to encourage the R&D to take place in the UK. So that's the main changes proposed on R&D. Watch this space. It's one of those things, as I say, that I think they're going to consult on, and we'll get some more detail in the future. One of the other topics that Kirsten mentioned was the asset holding company regime changes. So that's been confirmed that from April 2022, the new rules will come in for asset holding companies. A very welcome change for funds, and clearly something where the UK is trying to encourage investment in the UK, not just from a tax perspective, but more generally, trying to introduce a regime that, you know, wrenches some of the work that places like Luxembourg get in terms of fund structures to pull it back into the UK by trying to bring in a more tax efficient regime to encourage people to put those businesses here. So the main provisions will be for an asset holding company to qualify will be that 70% needs to be owned by diversely owned funds or institutional investors. And the provisions effectively are very wide ranging, and they effectively have a whole host of exemptions that switch off or amend quite a large chunk of the kind of rules in the UK that you would be familiar with normally having to apply to holding companies and particularly vehicles in fund structures. So it's things like allowing deductions for interest that would otherwise be distributions for UK tax purposes, switching off the late paid interest rules to turn interest deductions back onto the accruals basis, turning off the deeply discounted securities rules, removing the need to withhold tax on certain payments of interest, allowing payments of premiums on a repurchase of shares to be treated as capital distributions for investors rather than treating the premium as a dividend, which is a very significant sort of fundamental piece in our UK legislation normally. And if you're a remittance basis investor, that, you know, normally a payment out of a UK entity would be treated as UK source and taxable. But the provisions are going to allow you to effectively look through the underlying structure to look at the source of the funds so that some of those returns could actually be non-UK sources of remittance basis users. So pretty broad ranging from a UK perspective. There are a few other bits and pieces in there that are designed to help as well. So I would say this is probably a fairly wholesale change for us in the UK in terms of having a separate regime for dealing with these sorts of businesses. And we wait and see how that encourages people to put that activity in the UK. But I would say certainly very welcome and very favourable looking regime. Something else I think Jonathan mentioned earlier, corporate re-domiciliation. So as Jonathan mentioned, we get asked by this a lot of the time, particularly by our colleagues in Europe, where they find it much easier to just move businesses around or reclassify the legal seat of an entity from one country to another. And we've always in the UK just had to say, we don't have any provisions like that. If you want to come to the UK, you've got to wholesale move your business out of the entity and put it in a newly formed one. But the government have now realised that, you know, they want to try and encourage people to bring business to the UK, and therefore they need to make it easier for them to do that. So they have announced a consultation to look at introducing effectively a regime whereby you can re-domicile to the UK. So again, one to watch this space and definitely welcome. A final point just to mention from me, and again, I think Kirsten might have mentioned this earlier, is just the usual, what feels like usual now, extension of the annual investment allowance. I think every time it's very close to, you know, to its death date in terms of expiry, the government come back and extend the period for which the 1 million annual investment allowance is due. So it was due to expire at the end of this year. It's now been extended for that 1 million to 31st March 2023. And we wait to see whether it gets extended again. But we have confirmation we've got another couple more years in it yet. That's everything from me.
Thanks for that, Claire. Yeah, certainly I found it interesting just on the concern over R&D activity actually being sort of carried on outside the UK. I mean, the Chancellor came up with some, it's almost sort of playground maths really, you know, around the fact that I think the claims, if you look at all of the claims, that sort of gross spend equates to about 48 billion or something on R&D, but yet investment has only increased by 20 something, which gave him a sort of 23 billion delta of activity that's presumably being funded from here but carried on elsewhere. I think you need a large pinch of salt for that one personally, but there you go. It was clearly something he felt reasonably strongly about. Our next topic is those changes that were announced yesterday that we think are particularly pertinent to the sort of distress arena. So I'm happy to say that we've got our head of restructuring tax with us this morning, who's Paul Baldwin. And there's a couple of measures which I think fairly subtle measures in terms of the impact might not be obvious, but I think for those of us that deal with distress situations day in, day out, they're perhaps a little bit more significant than meets the eye. So, Paul, over to you.
Thanks, Jonathan. Good morning, everybody. Yes, a couple of things. As Jonathan said, they're fairly subtle. One links back to what a few of my colleagues have now talked about, which is distress on the high street, and it's broader than that. It's anybody else using real estate as a tenant. And this is to make sure that anybody who's frankly unfortunate enough to have to account for leases under IFRS 16 can avail themselves of the same benefits as anybody else not using that accounting standard. And this relates to onerous lease provisions and their release after a restructuring where you've reorganized your leases, hopefully reduced rent burden, and some provisions can be released. So currently there is an exemption there which takes the credits, which would otherwise be a dry tax charge, it takes those out of the restrictions that were brought in 2017 relating to corporate losses, effectively meaning that you're not capped as only being able to shelter 50% of them. The problem was that at the time nobody had envisaged the concept of right of use assets. So that's going to be fixed. The provisions in the CTA 2010 are going to be extended, not seeing the drafting yet. And mercifully, it's going to be a retrospective provision back to the 1st of January 2019. So hopefully aligning with everybody adopting the IFRS. So it should mean a level playing field for tenants who are enjoying the benefit of the release of those provisions. The other provision Jonathan referred to is probably only going to be sort of recollection for those of us who've been playing in tax for quite a while now. It certainly seemed that back in the early 2000s, you didn't start a day in the office without hearing about the latest twists and turns in a case involving Marks and Spencer and their desire to use overseas losses to shelter profits in the UK. Now, of course, UK being part of the EU at the time, when ultimately the European courts ruled in favour of Marks and Spencer, HMRC were obliged to implement rules that meant these losses in overseas jurisdictions could be used here in the UK. However, the distressed element of that was that they implemented those rules so narrowly that effectively, unless you were shutting up shop overseas, liquidating, never to return to that jurisdiction, those losses were pretty much unavailable to the hopefully profitable business here in the UK. So very narrow use, and I think actually this was one of the areas where there was a costing in deep buried in the announcements yesterday. It doesn't move the needle much, so I think it's safe to say that most people found this provision so difficult to use they probably didn't bother. But anyway, one of the many things Mr. Sunak decided to say was a benefit of coming out of the EU was the repeal of these cross-border group relief provisions. And that's going to be with effect from yesterday. So it's gone, you've had it, but it appears that not many people were using it anyway. So that's about it in the distressed arena. Certainly from a tax perspective, I think there's lots of other things to come, but we'll deal with those as and when they appear. Jonathan.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. I thought it was telling, as you just sort of mentioned there, that the repeal of the cross-border loss relief is effective from yesterday, unlike, as Marvin sort of mentioned, a lot of measures have been deferred until 2023. And the reason that we're kind of looking at the cross-border loss relief in terms of distress is you wonder to what extent there are UK businesses with European subsidiaries that have struggled, stroke collapsed during the pandemic. Who might otherwise have, been able to relieve those losses, would have fit into those narrow criteria for being able to claim relief for the overseas losses here in the UK. And so I think, the fact that it's effective from yesterday, that's maybe just sort of telling in government strategy there. Obviously, the onerous lease stuff, as we will see more and more CVAs, and that's really where the onerous lease stuff really could otherwise bite. So agree with you, very, very welcome. I'm conscious we've not seen many questions coming through yet. We've got another 15 minutes. So please don't be shy. We've got all the experts on keen to deal with any hot potatoes in real time. In the meantime, our final panelist this morning is Louise Jenkins, who heads up our employment and reward tax offering. Louise, obviously we heard about some of the pain, if you like, I guess the beginning of last month. So perhaps you could just sort of recap on that and let us know of anything else that caught your attention yesterday.
Well, thank you, Jonathan, and good morning, everybody. It was a relatively quiet budget actually for in the reward and employment taxes space, so I'm not going to be able to use up the last 15 minutes of this session talking about changes at the budget the Chancellor announced yesterday. But I think the fact that it was a relatively quiet budget will come as welcome news to most employers and their employees who are seeking to return to a new normal as the CJRS scheme has now come to an end. The final claims are now being made this week. And I think it will be interesting to see how employers respond to the end of the CJRS scheme. There was no extension made, particularly for the sectors hardest hit, hospitality, retail, leisure, despite there being continued calls for continued support. But perhaps the Chancellor felt that these sectors were benefiting from the business rate relief measures instead that he announced yesterday. So one of the biggest announcements that was actually made pre yesterday's speech heralded an increase to both the national minimum wage and the national living wage rates from 1st of April 2022, with the national living wage increasing to £9.50 an hour, which is a 6.6% increase. I think the government has made its policy very clear and its intentions very clear that employers should fund the employment and make it an attractive place to work. So these changes will give, on average, a full-time employee an extra £1,000 a year due to the increases. So as most of you, I'm sure, are aware, last month we saw this at the announcement of the new health and social care levy, which will also see an increase in employer costs. So the new health and social care levy with an interim for the tax year 2022-23 as a 1.25% increase in employee national insurance, employer national insurance, and as confirmed yesterday, a 1.2% increase on dividend income as well, is being introduced from April 2022. So those of you who have responsibility for staff forecasts, budgets, will need to take both of these measures into account when you're looking at your forecasting from next year. There was also some very minor administrative changes made to permit the government to extend tax reliefs temporarily in the event of a disaster or emergency of a national significance. Let's hope those aren't needed for quite some time yet. So these will permit them to extend tax reliefs and exemptions quickly without the need for a Finance Act. And we obviously saw the need for these types of steps when the government sought to extend certain CJRS testing costs from tax and to enable the tax-free supply of home office equipment to those working from home as a result of the lockdown measures. One other small change that was announced yesterday was the new company van benefit for 2022-23. It's been increased to £3,600. And the van fuel benefit increases to 688. Now, the reason I mention this is because company car vans remain a relatively low value benefiting kind, especially when you compare them to traditional company cars. So it's worth employers examining their fleet and van provisions to either take advantages of the tax exemptions available if private use is limited, or to provide vans rather than cars. In obviously suitable circumstances. The final change, again, will affect probably only a relatively small majority of employers, was the company fuel benefit multiplier charge was also going to be increased to £25,300 from April 2022. So if employers haven't already reviewed their fuel provision policy now's the time to do so. It's very expensive to provide fuel benefit to warrant the very high tax cost that arises. It's also difficult to justify, perhaps under a green policy, continuing to provide company fuel. A point just worth noting that if employers repay their private fuel ahead of the form P11D deadline, the 6th of July, the benefit in kind charge can be avoided. So strong controls are in place to ensure this is effective. But as I said before, company fuel benefits are very, very expensive benefit in kind to provide these days. So that's it really from an employment perspective. As I say, some headline changes made in advance of the budget, and just a few minor tweaks that were announced yesterday.
Thank you, Louise. I shall look forward to us all driving around in vans.
It's the way forward, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Louise, just one point just may be of interest to actually quite a lot of clients is we're already seeing CJSR, CJRS, that's the right way around, the Lewis Shows and Furlough Scheme, audits coming down the line, even though the scheme is only just closing. So watch out for that. We have a couple of clients already who've been notified that their claims are being audited. So it does look like it's going to be something where there's going to be a post.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, they, as you say, Marvin, we've seen a number of audits opened.
Yeah, it certainly feels like, you know, maybe some smaller businesses, less well-advised businesses have maybe pushed the envelope a little bit.
Yeah, I think, and also I think it's quite technical in terms of what you should pay.
It was a highly complex scheme that came in very quickly and then evolved over a relatively short period of time. So it's perhaps not surprising that, you know, companies perhaps didn't get it right because there was just so much going on. And it seems, as I say, as you mentioned, Marvin, it seems to be an area where HMRC are actively opening audits into the bigger claims.
Luckily, Tracy and the team are all over it.
Yes, we are.
It's great for my R35 into
correct seamless transition.
Further audits, excellent. Okay, so we've just got a couple of minutes left of the allotted time. So just to do a question come through on the changes to the beer duty, rather predictably that someone asked about that.
This is not your own microbrewery question,
Delphus. Well, actually, there is a new tax relief for microbreweries. So Marvin's looking, for those of you who know me, I do have a small microbrewery, my branches, but, you know, I was involved in the lobbying. But, you know, joking apart, there was quite a significant package of simplification measures announced around the operation of alcohol duty yesterday. But the question is, and I think it's probably one for you, Marvin, as head of our hospitality offering, is, you know, of what comfort will the reduction in the taxes on draft beer, of what comfort will that be to the leisure industry?
That's goodness only knows how elastic is the demand for beer. These three, is it 3p a pint, isn't it?
Yes,
is 3p a pint enough? I mean that people are going to simply drink more, pay more to restaurants, hotels, and anybody else that sell beer. Who knows? I think it's pretty finely balanced. There were certainly a few in the department yesterday who were cheering the Prosecco and Rosé production. So that got a big cheer, I think. But big bold reds for the winter cold months look like they're going to cost a bit more. So I think it's pretty much give with one hand, take away with another, really. The overall direction of travel, obviously, was one of being encouraging people to drink lower alcohol products, which is essentially a healthy and healthy measure to reduce illness, really. So, yeah, direction of travel and the policy, I think, is one of his more sensible moves. Whether it moves the needle, don't think so. Jonathan, will you drink more beer now? 3p a pint, chief?
No, I don't think that. I think the point is that I can't see that. You know, I think it will go straight to margin, the 3 pints. So, you know, straight to margin. But clearly, you know, I imagine the industry, I mean, it's your space, I imagine the industry would have preferred another year of a reduction in the
VAT.
The basic rate of VAT.
Yeah, correct. It's worth more.
Yeah.
It's worth more. So he's taken away with one hand the VAT from March next year, April next year, and on the other hand, he's given you 3p a pint, which you may or may not take in margin.
Yeah, agreed. I think that's it. I don't think there's any other questions. So just
two questions on my screen, Jonathan. So great. Someone's asked, there were two questions, I think, in the Q&A. Have you got them on your screen?
Shout them out, Claire, if you don't mind.
Okay, it says, given the Chancellor's statement that he expects tax take to fall, does the panel expect corporation tax to be less than 25%?
Well, it's a good question. His actual forecasts in terms of corporate tax take actually have gone up every year from, well, he has a baseline of the March budget numbers, and in each year for the 5 years going forward, I can't pull the numbers up, there's too many schedules, but broadly speaking, from my memory of it, I can actually find it, the numbers go up compared to March by 7.8 million next year, 4.4 billion in 23-24, 3.5 billion in 25-26, and 4 billion in 25-26. So no, he seems to be still expecting corporate tax take to show greater increases than we previously expected.
It's quite interesting, isn't it, given that I think the next election will be is all 23-24.
Yeah.
If you look at policy announcements and the wider thing of, you know, attracting more business to the UK, it doesn't make you wonder whether that is one of the things that falls into kind of never category, and there will be some backtracking going on for that as part of the election.
Be surprised if we get the announcement this is postponed or deferred or cancelled.
Yeah.
And that'll be interesting because obviously companies will have started providing, the public company will start providing at least the deferred tax to be at 25% before it comes into being on the basis that the reversal timing of gas is going to be around April 23. So it will have an impact on EPS effectively.
Yeah.
It does cancel.
But of course, we have the cancellation of the 19-17%, similar sort of thing, where obviously it was the opposite way around.
Well, my personal view is that I think it won't happen. I guess to a certain extent, the Red Book, they've got to price things on, you know, what they've said
what's announced,
what has been announced. It really, really wouldn't surprise me if, you know, particularly election year or whatever, that, you know, the facts and circumstances have changed sufficient to give him, you know, reason either not to go through with that, or to go through a lower rate. I think it's crazy. I think the, you know, if you're looking at businesses sort of planning with any certainty, you know, one, if you speak to any sort of overseas headquartered group, really what they want is certainty.
Right.
A stable environment, and all this chopping and changing is just not healthy, frankly. Obviously, if you're sort of deciding to locate certain sort of portable revenue streams in the UK on the premise of taxing them at 17% and now it's 25%, I mean, that's the difference between the ROI working and not working.
Yeah. And one scary thought is Trump will probably be back in the White House. So the US will have reaffirmed that 21% tax rate for our next election. So is that something where we want to have a higher rate, significantly higher rate than the US? But,
no.
So the other question, Jonathan, you can see on the screen there, your eyesight's good, is asking about environmental measures and whether they lived up to the government's net zero strategy.
I guess obviously against the backdrop of COP26, we were perhaps expecting a bit more on environmental matters. I mean, one of the things that struck me as really counterintuitive was the reduction of air passenger duty for internal flights. Do we really need to? I think the policy objective was to, you know, increase connectivity. within the UK, but do we really all need to be jumping on planes to go to Edinburgh and burning all this kerosene up? It sounded really, I say, counterintuitive when set against the green agenda. That said, there were certainly a number of sort of measures within measures that spoke to the sort of environmental angle. So, for example, within the business rates reform, there's going to be sort of special relief where premises have invested in green technologies. And there were a number of other sort of incentives. There was also, of course, we're obviously tax professionals, we concentrate on the tax side, but on the spend side of the equation, because it was a spending review as well, there was obviously a lot of investments in green infrastructure, wind, etc. So I would say, in summary, probably lower key on the green stuff, some slightly eyebrow raising stuff, but definitely measures within measures aimed to incentivize through tax policy rather than spend the use of green technologies, but could have done more, could do better, would be my report card. Great. That is all the questions now. We've just got a couple of minutes over, so it just really remains for me to thank all of our panelists this morning. Thanks, guys. It's been a really interesting discussion. To thank all the people who joined us, all of our attendees this morning. Really pleased that you could tune in. Obviously, if any of the issues that we've talked about, particularly impacting business, we'd welcome carrying on the discussion directly. Hopefully, the next time we're doing something like this, we'll have a few of you in the office with us. That's maybe something for early next year. But in the meantime, enjoy the rest of your days, and we'll catch up with you all soon. Thanks.